Hartman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is George Jensen. I represent the appellate and would like to reserve 2 minutes.
Okay, proceed.
Your Honors, we are here today asking you to remand this case back to Superior Court for trial based upon several errors that occurred in the summary judgment proceeding that occurred in January of last year. First of all, I'd like to bring into the fact that there's material fact left to be determined whether or not there was an existing contract to be determined. I accept the fact that throughout the pleadings, my client had yelled forgery, forgery, but as is shown in our briefing, that was rectified by the respondent at the last minute after all the pleadings had been entered for the summary judgment hearing. There was a valid contract. So there is a material fact to determine if that is enforceable or not, and the factual materials that came from that.
I'm not quite sure what you mean when you say it was rectified by opposing counsel at the last minute. What are you talking about?
Yes, Your Honor. What we mean by that is throughout the proceedings, the respondents, defendants, had posited a operating agreement for the LLC.
My client posited it without giving you a copy?
No, gave us a copy. The signature on it was not my client's signature. It was not notarized. The date that it was given did not match with where my client lived at the time that was printed on the document. My client did not remember signing it. After our pleadings had been filed in the summary judgment, in fact, the day after our response was due, the respondents provided to us a copy of this operating agreement signed by my client. No question, it was his signature this time, notarized with a date on it that matched the address that was also printed on it.
Same agreement.
Same agreement entirely.
So what accounted for the fact that there was a different signature or a different notary or something on the
that record? Has never been answered. Our issue is my client did not remember signing it, so he yelled forgery. He does not dispute that he signed it now. He certainly disputes that it is valid. And we made this oral representation.
They brought this other copy in, and this was after all the pleadings and summary judgment had been completed, so it was like just before the argument in front of the trial judge, or what?
In fact, I believe that it was on December 11th of 2015. Counsel and myself were in Arizona on a deposition on this case, and it was presented during that deposition. Our response was due the day before. It was put in, so we couldn't include that in our materials.
Did you make an issue of that with the trial court and say, oh, now we realize that there is a valid written agreement, we need more time under CR 56F to respond to the motion?
Your Honor, we noted that it was and that it did appear to be a valid, that there did appear to be a valid contract. We made sure that we conceded the fact that there was a valid agreement in this. But even looking at that, the court determined that it was not a valid agreement, that contract at that time. Secondly, there is material fact that if there is a valid agreement, the guaranteed payments have to adhere to that agreement, to that contract. Whereas, because the contract clearly states in there, as noted in our brief, that there was a requirement of both members, owners of the LLC, to agree in writing to any financial arrangements, of which this was one.
So you're getting that from the contract, which you now agree did exist.
Yes, we do agree did
exist.
And
so did you make that argument to the trial court, or is it now only to us?
We made the concession that at the day of the hearing that the contract was presented after the fact that we do agree that it is valid.
And did you then make the argument, and Your Honor, now that we do agree that there is a valid written contract, there is this provision in it which should cause us to win because it requires everybody to sign.
We made the argument we made was that at the trial court level was that we require that Mr. Hartman, the respondent, made the payments to himself unilaterally, and that we made those arguments under breach of fiduciary responsibility.
Not tied to the written contract.
Not necessarily tied to the written contract at that time, because once again, this happened all at the last minute.
Well, I know, but the reason
we are
pressing for these details is because, I mean, we can only review decisions that are made by the trial judge based on the arguments that are made to the trial judge. Regardless of the evidence was there, if you're not making the argument, the trial court's not going to look for that evidence.
And I wish I could say, absolutely, I made that argument per se, but there was no record of it. And I do not remember exactly the context. I remember I brought it up. I did not write the briefs that we put that out to Mr. Tingstad.
Isn't it generally true? Isn't it fair to say that, I mean, in summary judgment proceedings, that if something happens at the last minute and you're discombobulated, the evidence is not what you expected, that's the right moment to go in and say, Your Honor, could we please have a continuance under 56F because we have this new evidence, we want to develop a new theory.
Your Honor, we also the problem is we were also pressing at that time for trial the following week, which we'd been scheduled for.
So maybe you have to get a continuance to trial.
And the court was very reluctant to do that at that point because it had been continued. We were running 3 years into this case. They wanted this case resolved. And I certainly understand where you're coming from on this. But the simple fact is that the court was made aware that there was a contract, that the material facts within that contract had been presented to the court, and that we now asserted were true.
Was that document before the trial court, the new contract?
Yes, I believe it was.
Is it in our record on appeal?
Yes, it should be in your record on appeal. The new contract is not.
Okay.
The new contract, the one with the actual valid signature, is not. The one with the incorrect signature. But the same terms are, and the ones with the correct signature is on that. I can advance a little bit here. Now, finally, with regard to factual evidence, at the end of the, after my client left in 2008, and Mr. Hartman then began to run this company into the ground, he, while paying himself handsomely to do that, there were assets. The client, respondent has made the allegation there were no assets left at the time. Everything was encumbered, and he bought it. That just doesn't fit with it. In his tax returns, it showed a massive amount of tools, showed other equipment. The relative small amount that was purchased at auction, $5,000, but from First Sound Bank, just doesn't mesh. That's a question of fact that should have been determined by the fact finder, not by the court on summary judgment. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Marianne Jones and I represent Brett Hartman. The question on this appeal is whether the record supports any basis for which this case should go back to the trial court. And we suggest that there is no basis in this record. There's truly what I see as an equitable argument coming forth from Holroyd at this point, simply saying to the court, without really any law or pleadings, that says that $263,288 in guaranteed payments between 2008 and 2011 is not proper. Really, there is no there's no claim that fits that in this case, and there really wasn't anything that was pled. We've got the derivative claims, and then we've got the direct claims, and I'll focus on the direct claims at first. The direct claims that were somewhat pled, and I'll say somewhat because we don't believe that that they pled the standing properly, but for the moment, I'll put that aside. The direct claims that remained for summary judgment were breach of fiduciary duty and breach of contract. Both of those claims, when you look at what the damages and the cause of breach or injury in this case, there's no evidence in this record of any of that. Now, Holroyd points to the $263,288 that is that's the breach, is what he's saying. And I'm sorry, that's the causation, that's the damages, but it's not. What he needed to do to make this record sufficient was he needed to bring in evidence or a CPA or an expert that links, that takes the company back to that point in time in 2008 and says, here's the creditors that existed at that time. Here's the debt. Here's the lease obligations on the assets. Here's where we are. And walks the company through those creditors and those payments that were made, and then comes out at the end with Hartman having a positive capital account. And that simply is not in this record. Where we are in this record is we have...
Didn't Hartman pay himself a wage?
That's the guaranteed payments. That's the $263,288.
And did the LLC agreement authorize him unilaterally to authorize himself a wage?
It does. The agreement is absent of that. It just doesn't say. However,
does it give either of the members the right to unilaterally make that decision? Because if it didn't, then he wouldn't have had authority.
It doesn't specifically say it. However, the decision to unilaterally do it is implied through the IRS obligations. So the IRS requires a partner who works it for the business. Then that's the critical part. If you're putting in your daily hours, you must get paid by the partnership. Otherwise, the IRS is just going to deem that you did get paid, and they're going to put in their own number. And so this evidence that should be in the record from Holroyd should contain evidence of what would have happened had guaranteed payments not been made, because that would be an IRS obligation at that point. And that's what we would have come back with on our response. We would have said that, no, here's what the law is. And I think if you have a legal situation where you must comply with the IRS rules that say if you work for this entity, you must be paid a wage, or guaranteed payments is what they're called in this case, then that's an issue that can't be overcome by some other agreement or something that is lacking in an agreement. So just because we have this number of guaranteed payments, this amount of guaranteed payments, doesn't create a genuine issue of material fact that needs to go to the trial court. And that's our point here. I believe that Holroyd honestly feels that the foreclosure that happened on the personal property and the guaranteed payments is what he feels is the proof of damages and proof of causation and proof of injury for those two claims, breach of fiduciary duty and breach of contract. But the fact that these payments were made does not make an issue of material fact. And that's the crux of our argument. Secondly, the injury must be proven to be Holroyd's individually as opposed to the entity. And in this case, that hasn't been proven, meaning he has to show how it would have made his capital account positive. And as we see in the capital accounts, they are negative, and negative on both sides, about equally. And as a result, he would have had to put money in to go back to zero and then go up from there. Now, as to the other issues, the derivative action was strategically dismissed, and that was because that was in the previous summary judgment, the one in 2014. If Holroyd didn't dismiss his derivative action, then it would have raised issues of all other claims from creditors, And there were still creditors out there. And so that was strategic, and I don't think that it's proper to appeal that voluntary, concession of that claim on summary judgment. Other problems with...
It seems like there's something in the briefs from counsel that suggests that, he said that then, but then as the litigation went on, it came back and was argued. Is that not the case?
That's not the case at all.
The last word about it was when he agreed to withdraw it.
Yes. What was argued is that the claims for breach of fiduciary duty and claims for breach of contract were derivative in nature and in the manner in which they were being argued. They weren't individual. And that was our point. You have to bring those claims as individual claims. You have to show where you're individually injured, not derivatively. And so to the extent that the word derivative was used in argument, that's the context. Holroyd never pled that he asked Hartman to sue or attempted to do that. He never pled that was futile. And we believe that RCW 25.15380 has the verbiage shall within it. And we believe that also provides a standing issue for Holroyd in this case. As to the issue about the contract, this is a case, and the record doesn't really reflect the lack of discovery here, but had there been any discovery to ask for any document or thing, that would have been brought out. The contract that was notarized was brought out in a deposition, and in fact, the summary judgment that was set in December actually occurred in January. So there's a full month that was given to address those issues if necessary. And the trial was continued to March. So there really wasn't any time issue where counsel couldn't address those issues. I think that counsel went forward and the issue for the court was, because we really tried to say, look, even if we accept that we have a valid contract, whether we accept their first position on the contract or their next position, there still is no causation, there still is no damage, there still is no argument, there's no proof in the record that shows that these capital accounts would have been any different than they are today, based upon all of the the creditors. So if you have any more questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
With regard to the day of the trial, I apologize. I was incorrect. It was March. I do remember that now. It was moved to first week in March because of our summary judgment being moved to January. Our summary judgment was originally scheduled for December 18th, and it was later moved. With regard to the contract, the original contract was provided by the defendant in discovery and was never updated by the defendant until the deposition after they had received our response in the summary judgment motion. They had known that we objected to it several times. They waited to the last minute to provide us with a new copy after our ability to present it to the court. Now, with regard to whether or not there are personal damages or not, let's take a look at whether or not there is a fiduciary responsibility by Mr. Hartman to Mr. Holroyd in this matter. Start with Bishop and Victoria. It clearly analogizes the partnership statute, which prevents self-dealing. And that in itself, his self-dealing, that $263,280 is, in fact, not only self-dealing, but negatively impacts Mr. Holroyd's capital account on this. If that had been awarded as profits to the corporation, that would have had a positive impact upon Mr. Holroyd's capital account, and it would have had a negative, the extra amount taken by Mr. Hartman would have had a negative amount on his capital account. So therefore, his breach of the fiduciary duties, breach of the contract, do have direct damages to the to the issue of whether or not Mr. Holroyd did suffer a personal damage. With regard to the derivative action, they've offered no proof of voluntarism in this case. Thank you.